All right. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. It's good to see a good crowd to enjoy our process here at COGFA. I'd like to start with calling COGFA to order and start off with a roll call.
Senator Aquino. Representative Davidsmeyer.
Here.
Senator DeWitt. Representative Harper. Representative Hernandez. Senator Kaler. Senator Lewis. Representative Moeller. Senator Sims. Representative Sosnowski. Senator Severson. Representative Weaver. 7 members present.
And with 7 members, I believe we have a quorum. We can go ahead and start with our first panel. If CMS can come up, and we'll talk about the fiscal year 2027 group insurance program.
Good morning.
Morning. Small table, be careful.
All right. A lot of people. All right. Good morning. Thank you, Leader Kaler, Leader Davidsmeyer, and members of the Commission. My name is Raven Devon, and it is my absolute honor to continue serving as Director of the Illinois Department of Central Management Services. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you again this year. CMS continues to play a critical role in delivering essential services to a wide range of stakeholders, including state agencies, boards, commissions, and local partners. At the core of our mission is the administration of comprehensive health benefits to state employees, retirees, and their eligible dependents. Today, we are proud to support more than 470,000 covered lives, reflecting both scale and importance of the work we do every single day. Over the past year, CMS successfully navigated one of the most significant transitions in our recent history, the unexpected independent exit of Health Alliance from the marketplace. Through a proactive and comprehensive communication strategy, we ensured that more than 60,000 impacted members and covered dependents experienced a smooth and seamless transition to new coverage. This effort required rapid coordination, clear and consistent outreach through mailings and emails, and a strong partnership with agencies and members across the state. Our team worked closely with members to limit disruption to employees. For example, where we were made aware of prior authorization requests for medication, we flagged those requests as members found different health plans. The success of this transition reflects our commitment to putting members first and delivering stability during times of change. As we look ahead, CMS is focused on enhancing the member experience and improving health outcomes through innovative tools and services. Next month, we are launching Health Advocate, a new frontline support service for members and their covered dependents. Health Advocate will serve as a single trusted point of contact for navigating the healthcare system. Through this service, members will have access to experts who can help find in-network providers, assist with scheduling appointments and transferring medical records, clarify tests and treatment plans, identify prior authorization requirements, resolve claims and billing issues, answer benefit-related questions, and explore treatment options and obtain second opinions. By providing this high-touch, concierge-level support, Health Advocate will significantly improve the member experience while also allowing CMS to focus more directly on strategic program management and oversight. Also launching next month in conjunction with the start of open enrollment, CMS is proud to unveil a redesigned Benefits Hub, an evolution of the My Benefits program platform. This new centralized hub will provide a streamlined one-stop shop experience where members can easily access and manage all of their benefit programs, including health plans, flexible spending accounts, health saving accounts, and deferred compensation. By integrating our benefit vendors into a single user-friendly platform, we are making it easier for members to find the information they need and take action with confidence. Our work continues into the summer as we expand our commitment to wellness through enhancements to the Be Well program. In July 2026, we will launch Be Well Total Wellbeing, a new interactive wellness platform designed to meet members wherever they are on their health journey. This mobile-friendly platform will allow members to participate in friendly wellness challenges with colleagues, set personal goals and track progress, access educational content focused on physical, mental, and nutritional health, and earn incentive points for engagement, which can be redeemed for rewards such as gift cards. This evolution reflects the state of Illinois' ongoing commitment to a comprehensive, accessible, and engaging approach to wellness. In addition to digital enhancements, CMS continues to bring preventative care directly to employees across the state. Over the past year, we have partnered with the Illinois Department of Transportation, the Illinois Department of Agriculture, and the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency to provide nearly 500 on-site skin cancer screenings, expanding access to early detection services, and helping improve the health of a few of our colleagues. Just last month, CMS Benefits hosted an angiogram screening in Springfield. With more than 200 people participating, we have additional screenings scheduled in both Chicago and Southern Illinois in the coming months. These initiatives are critical to identifying health risks early, improving outcomes, and reducing long-term costs. As we reflect on the past year and look ahead, CMS remains committed to delivering high-quality, cost-effective health benefits while continuously improving the experience of those we serve. Through thoughtful innovation, strong partnerships, and a focus on preventative care, we are working to ensure the long-term health and well-being of our members and fiscal sustainability of our programs. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm joined at the table by Carrie Wolf, our statewide chief benefits officer, and Colin Brewer, our benefits finance officer. In the room, I'm also joined by Andre Williams, our assistant director, Karen Pate, our chief financial officer, Aaron O'Boyle, chief of staff, and other members of our senior leadership team. Thank you, and we are open to any questions you may have.
Thank you, Director. Do we have any questions at this time? Oh, yeah. Let me add Representative Weaver and Representative Moeller to the roll. Leader Kaler.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. And I was one of those people caught in that transition between Health Alliance and a new plan last year. And I brought up some of those issues, and I can report that my knee surgery went well, no issues. I received no phone calls from anybody because usually we hear all the noise on that. So you obviously did a good job, and I just want to say thank you. Thank you for that. The question I have is, did Health Alliance live up to all of its commitments in terms of this transition?
I think the short is, first of all, thank you, and we're glad to hear that your transition, because you had surgery, I think, in June, right, like
yes,
late June.
Yep.
So you were right close to the cusp. So good to hear that what we said we would deliver was delivered. I think the short answer is yes. If there are additional specific items that you're asking for, Carrie can answer.
Is there any issues as people, because there's quite a large number of people that switched from Health Alliance to some of the other plan. Were there any network issues, accessibility issues? I think most people went in probably to the OAP.
Correct. You hit the nail on the head. Of course, as you know, DOI, the Department of Insurance, makes sure that they regulate our accessibility and coverage. We've met all of those minimums, even with the transition, and the likelihood is that the vast majority of folks, probably close to like 60% of Health Alliance folks, ended up going over to one of the OAPs because they could have a more comprehensive provision in that area.
Is there any backlog of bills with Health Alliance, or are they completely cleared out at this point?
He says we're completely...
Okay. So we're starting a new day then. Well,
correct.
Again, my thanks.
Senator Severson.
Good morning. Thank you. Couple things. First, the cost, advocate program, what's the cost going to be for running that program?
So the specific cost of the advocate program or overall what it costs to have TELUS, who's our partner?
Well, what's the added cost of setting up this concierge-type service? What's the, you know, what?
I don't think there's an additional cost to what we're, there is.
Okay. We've been in discussions with TELUS, and it's very preliminary right now because we're trying to get a better understanding of what we think the actual take-up rate and the completion rates are going to be based on their experience and their other books of business. But I think the initial estimate of that particular cost was about $1.5 million.
Okay. All right. And then are you going to be reviewing overall liability and the plans and the memberships of the things that are part of your liabilities, the whole booklet? Are you going to be reviewing those numbers today or just here just to answer those questions?
We can't quite hear you well, so is your question, are we reviewing liabilities?
Are you going over, I guess? Otherwise, I'll just ask you a few of these questions. The membership, we talked a little bit about this last year too. The membership in the HSA plan continues to be abysmal. Obviously, you only have less than 3,100 members total in that plan. Are we looking at trying to find a different way to market that or educate people to get to understand the benefits of the HSA plan versus the other options that we have?
Thank you for that question. We've had this. This is the third time I'm here and the third time we've had it, and I'm happy to report one thing, we have always had the information available to members to make the decision for the plan that makes the most sense for their lives. It has been in PDF form. That's where we have all of our information. And next month, with the launch of the reimagination of the My Benefits Hub, members will be able to go in and answer questions about their specific family makeup, and they will get a suggestion about the plan that makes the most sense for how they use, who they're covering, how they use their plan, and it will make a suggestion for that. We are hopeful that that will lead members to a different pathway in the event that the high deductible plan makes sense for their family.
From a cost standpoint, it's also somewhat interested. The fact that your high deductible health plan costs us less than $10,000 per participant, when your Q-chip plan is in excess of $17,000 per participant. So for a family of four, you're talking about $30,000 a year more for being in the Q-chip plan versus the high deductible. I mean, that's a dramatic cost difference. Yet from an employee contribution level, it's only $39 difference. The fact that we're HSA plans save the state so much money, and it's good for the employee, yet you charge the highest percentage of costs for people being in HSA versus the Q-chip. I think it's like 18 or 19% of the cost is borne by the employee under the HSA plan versus 12, 15% under the other plans. Is there a reason why we've almost disincentivized people wanting to go into HSA plans?
Well, I'm going to turn it over to Colin, but I don't view it as disincentivizing. I think that we've modeled all of our plans to make sure that they are financially sound and what would cost is appropriate. I will tell you from my experience, both as a user, but also as the leader of CMS, our members are set it and forget it, and for better or worse. If you entered, everyone I talked to who was affected by Health Alliance, Andre, our assistant director, he's been an estate employee 26 years. That was That was his plan, right? Like, they just said it and forget it. And so, not saying it's right or wrong, but that is the ethos of what our members typically do, whether or not you saw HMO. I don't know what an OAP is, so I'm going to try and stay with an HMO. Even though an OAP might be a better plan for them, they're comfortable. I think the high deductible plan came maybe a decade or so ago. And so I don't know that there's enough education out there, despite our efforts. And that's why we're hopeful now. It's gonna look very different. Now people will be making truly family-based decisions. Even though the information has been there, we've not had it in a more user-friendly pathway. When it comes to some of the specificity around the percentages, you know that's going to be Colin to answer that. So I'll turn it over to him.
All right. Colin, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Senator.
Colin Brewer, the chief, the benefits finance officer for CMS. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself earlier. That is definitely something that I have noticed as I'm watching the financials of this program, and it has actually increased in terms of what they're paying as a percentage of the cost over the last couple of years. I think the one point that I would like to make would be that member contributions are a function of our collective bargaining agreements, primarily with AFSCME Council 31. So they, regardless of what the cost is, those employee contributions are locked in through the end of fiscal year 2027. But I am always very cognizant of what our members are paying in relation to the costs of the program. So it is going to be something that I'm sure we will discuss when we start the next round of bargaining agreement discussions.
So, because under the HSA plan, I mean, their employees can be paying only going to save $39 a month for going into the HSA plan, but the state's going to save almost $700 a month. And so it's like, why don't we take part of that savings and either lower the cost for the HSA plan or deposit a larger, as we do now, deposit a larger incentive into that HSA account to take that savings that the state would have, put some of that in there to encourage more people to go into that HSA plan.
I believe that the amount that we deposit, the employer's contribution, is reliant upon language in the Group Insurance Act that requires us to specifically put one-third of the plan year deductible is the employer's contribution, so we are limited by the statute in that regard. And again, with regard to the employee contributions, that's negotiated with the union. I have brought it to their attention. I don't want to speak specifically about our discussions that we have in collective bargaining, but I have brought it to their attention that I personally feel that it is much greater of a percentage in relative to what all of the other plans members are paying. So it's been discussed, it hasn't been changed, but it's something that I continue to watch, and I would advocate for people being able to get into an affordable plan at an affordable rate.
Okay, last question on that part. So with the upcoming negotiations with labor, is there going to be some education going on so they understand, because we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars difference cost to the state, but it would be also very, very helpful to the employees when they understand that. And so I hope there'd be a way to educate them. And also when you're dealing with these, anyone that, and you already know who the high claim users are, in the group, but anyone that has significant claims, HSA is going to be significantly better, less out of pocket for them for the course of the year, and so there's no downside to that. So I don't know if you're working with high claim users or doing consulting or having one reaching out to them, or if that's part of your concierge service to reach out to them, but it sort of seems like that would make sense.
Senator,
so hopefully you'll do that.
Just so for just education's sake, when we are negotiating with our labor partners, carrying benefits obviously is a large part of the discussion. Carrie and Colin are right there with the labor team. They are in some of the sidebar meetings. part of their job during that time is to say, here's where we are. Here's what could make sense or would make sense for your membership. They are there, not late into the night, just like our labor negotiators are. So there is no daylight, and while we can lead a horse to water, but know the rest.
Right, but I can't imagine labor would be opposed to the idea of lowering the cost of the health plan. So if you lowered the cost of the HSA plan, it would be a benefit to them and to the state. So hopefully that just, I would just ask that you make that part of that discussions, because it's with health costs going up so much, the more we could steer into that HSA would be a dramatic savings for the state of Illinois and the consumer. Then just quickly, on the Medicare Advantage plans, I know there were a number of issues that were raised before when that transition happened. Have there been any ongoing concerns or problems with that, with moving to the Advantage plan?
No. Last year there were large federal changes that precipitated. At the time that we awarded our MAPD plan, it was a $0 premium to our members. A copay, I'm sorry. Or it's a premium.
Yeah. Zero premium, yeah.
Yeah. I won't say unfortunately. Sweeping changes that occurred at the federal level last year necessitated about a $48 or $50 premium, and then additional changes have also occurred at the federal level. Now we're just under $100 per month, per member, and coverage remains on scale, not an issue. We just hate that at the time we awarded, the laws as they were allowed us to have a $0 premium, but since that time, obviously, the landscape has changed, and we've had to adjust.
So there is a premium now going to be charged, or just a cost to the state?
That's to the members.
To the members.
A little bit less than $100 per month. So they pay. We'll see. Colin will tell you the breakdown.
Yes.
Sure. I think you saw in the report that our overall liability projection was about $122 million for MAPD in fiscal 2027, and that's based on a premium that the state pays to Aetna, just like, as you mentioned, just under $100, or as the director mentioned. So, yes, to the state is the cost.
That's what the state's paying. Is the member paying anything at all?
Well, we're talking about the Medicare population, so folks over 65, and keep in mind about a little under 90% of our population has 20 years of service. So no matter what the cost is, they're not paying a premium whatsoever, right? And then the dependent contributions for MAPD were negotiated with the union at the beginning of this contract. So it's only $2.46 a month for a dependent in the MAPD, and that will continue through 27 as well.
Okay. And the concerns over network issues have been addressed with the, even though it's an Advantage plan, you don't have a network per se, or do you have a network under the Advantage plan?
There is, Carrie Wolf, Statewide Chief Benefits Officer. There is a network, quote unquote, for the plan. However, the plan also includes what is called an extended service provider or extended service program. So if a provider is not in network, but they do take Medicare and they are willing to bill the insurance carrier or Aetna for the services, the member pays the same as if they would have seen an in-network provider.
As long as you're willing to bill Aetna, so the retiree is not paying those differences, the state pays those differences?
It pays the same as if they would have seen an in-network provider. So
pays the same. I'm talking about to the
claim pays the same to the provider, and the member's co-insurance is the same as if they would have seen an in-network provider.
Okay, so from the employee standpoint, retiree is no difference.
Correct.
The provider has to agree to the Aetna contractual in-network rates if they want to do that.
No, the provider has to be enrolled with federal Medicare, mm-hmm. or to accept federal Medicare, and then they just have to agree to run the claim through. They have to agree to bill.
So if they file the claim, it's a higher rate than what your in-network rate would be.
That is not, that's a question you would have to ask to Aetna as far as how they reimburse that provider.
Okay. So you, all right. I guess the question would be, is that they're out of network, that provider I would think would be not charging an in-network rate, would be charging a higher rate. But we can, I guess, ask Aetna, but
yeah,
so you don't know if we're getting, if we're paying a higher reimbursement rate.
It's a fully insured plan, so the state is not paying anything on claims. We pay a premium to Aetna for those services, or for that insurance.
Okay. All right. And the projected cost this year is, you're saying it's about a 9%, is that about a 9% increase in overall costs for the program this year?
Correct.
Okay. And is that... the last couple of years we've been off a little bit. The rates have turned out to be a little bit higher, but everything we've been reading is that this is going to be one of the highest increasing years in healthcare in a long time. So, are you comfortable with that kind of at that suggested rate increase for the budget? And when any of the new mandates that we've passed, are they included in these numbers as well?
Yes, all relevant legislation that has an impact on the cost of the programs has been factored into the projection of liabilities for the budget year.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Can we add Senator Aquino to the roll? And I believe Representative Sosnowski.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Can I just do a couple quick follow-ups on the Senator's question regarding HSA? So that one-third statutory cap that you mentioned, I think you kind of highlighted that there are some advantages to the cost of the state. Has there been an analysis on modifying that or suggesting a modification to that statute to allow a little bit more flexibility for the contribution?
To the employer's contribution to it?
No, for the state's contribution in the HSA plan.
No, I haven't looked at what an impact that might have on the program to make a change.
Okay. Is that something that's worth looking at, to his point, you know, kind of offering an additional incentive for people to consider that plan?
I think if there's anything we can do to continue to provide the valued health care at a reasonable cost to the taxpayer, it's always worth looking at.
Okay. Who would initiate that? Is that something you look to the legislature to initiate the analysis of that? Because, again, I think that's some valid points that the cost of the state is less and we add $400 more as the state contribution, and maybe that incentivizes several hundred more employees to get involved. I mean, certainly I'd like to offer that flexibility to CMS to kind of analyze that. So if it means a little bit more than a third being the cap, you know, would that be good to give to you guys as far as power of that flexibility?
So I hear you, and so we will certainly take a look, and if there's an opportunity for us to collaborate, we will follow up with you, directly with your office.
Okay, that sounds great. And again, I know you kind of mentioned, you know, people get set, I'm the same, you know, you kind of stick it in a plan, but, you know, if it costs us less, we can give some more incentive there. I think that's positive. And just one more follow-up on that related to the educational aspect of that. I mean, I know we have our benefits period, the information shared. You kind of mentioned the survey or the analysis that, you know, people can input their data, stuff like that. It gets complicated, you know, I know, but there are advantages to the HSA plan for tax shelter growth of the deposits, things like that. Do we have educational seminars that we offer to state employees that, you know, kind of can dig into it, give them some time to really ask a lot of questions, give a lot of input and presentation-wise?
Yes, absolutely. Carrie's team is coming up to their month-long Super Bowl. That's the month of May, where they are all around the state having member benefit fairs. We had 21 last year, the most ever, and that basically means there's about 10 to 12 folks on Carrie's team that live on the road to spend full days in our area, in areas where we have lots of employees, to answer questions. I've attended several myself. And people do ask, bring their very complicated schemas to say what makes the most sense. Now, of course, we can't tell people what to do. What we are doing is saying, given all the information you've given us, you want to investigate this for your family or that. We do that. We'll probably have about 20 next month as well, and that is the main way. We also have the opportunity, folks can always call. They don't necessarily do that. The reality is people don't think about it until they have to, and this is about the time of year that they think about it because they've got to make a decision.
Yeah. So outside of that, can we do a little more outside of the benefit period? Because, again, I know it is complicated, you know, that plan to see the tax advantages and how that works. It takes a little longer for somebody to, you know, really sit down. Even then, they may not be interested in it. But, you know, I guess outside of the benefits period and that time, you know, are there opportunities or agencies or our partners that can come in and offer, you know, those seminars throughout the year that can kind of just say, hey, this is HSA. And maybe it's a couple different things that they analyze. But because it's more than, you know, 5-10 minutes or, you know, asking a couple questions. It's probably better in, you know, more of a 30-40 minute format to say, this is how it works, this is how HSAs work, you know, this is how your tax shelter, you know, things like that, and kind of lay that out for an individual. Or maybe there's a program. I you know, I'm just asking the question. I don't know what's out there.
Yeah, I mean, previously we've had like off-month seminars or update. The reality is they're not very well attended when it's not, the pressure is on. So then it's an operational decision. Do I have this to say I had it, or do I use that staff time to do something different? I think we're open if the will of the legislature is to suggest CMS take another crack at it. Totally happy to do that and also report kind of, you know, the number of usage. But to answer your question, yes, we have done it, just not well attended when it's not, the heat is on. Carrie, if you want to add to that.
I was just going to say that, yes, we do. As part of Be Well Illinois' initiative, it also has financial, it looks at the financial health of all of our enrollees. So there are occasions where we do webinars with Optum, who is the vendor that actually runs our HSA program. We do it for the HSA and also like the flexible spending accounts for MCAP and DCAP, in addition to doing financial webinars through our life insurance carrier and also deferred compensation. So anywhere there's an ability for an enrollee to get any financial education or, you know, a tax advantage information and things like that, we do provide that specifically during months that are focused on financial awareness.
Okay. And I don't need it now, but if you've got the provider for the HSA, if they've done a webinar in the past, is there any chance you might be able to share that if they have that content that might be recorded?
I will look and see if it is still out on our Be Well Illinois website. And if not, I'll see if we still have it, and we can share it with your office.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you. And then just one question on just overall liabilities and trend line. I guess could you just comment generally, you know, I'm looking at CAGFA's summary, and looks like from 24 to 27 fiscal year, you know, general liabilities are 38% increase. You know, obviously we've seen significant increases in liability over time. I think the last fiscal year it maybe seemed to drop a little bit. What do you see kind of in the future trend lines?
So I think at the core of your question is where have you been and why we are where we are today and where do you think we're going? It's complicated. It's not just one thing. In a different setting, actually tomorrow, I'll be appearing before the Senate General Probes, and they're going to say, CMS, what have you done on hiring? And I'm going to say, we've got the biggest state workforce we've had since 2007. And so on the one end, we'll talk about it 3:30. But some of your colleagues will say, well, what have you done? And we're going to say, you know, we've added about 10,000 employees since 2019. But the other end to that is we've added 10,000 employees. And so, of course, that means our increased liabilities, that means increased dependence. I do want to note, because I think it's just a cool data point, when you add the number of employees, I just assumed that it was going to come with like two or three dependents on average. It doesn't. It's about 1.3. And some of that is state employees there might already be a state employee in that home or whatever it is. So one, we've added quite a bit of employees to the state's roles to carry out critical functions. Certainly there's the general idea of inflation that we are all just fighting through as a country. That is some of the challenge. Different landscape as it relates to the insurance market and the cost of various drugs. Some things work in our favor, sometimes it doesn't. So it's not weird. We can't quite point to one specific thing that has increased our liabilities. I can tell you from a hiring perspective, CMS is, I won't say cooling our jets, but we're focusing more on retention. We have hired. Now, there will still be their critical roles, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. I know somebody's going to ask me about it. IDOT doesn't have engineers. We know. We're going to try and fix that. We're not going to stop trying to hire engineers at IDOT, but the mass hiring is more on retention. So hopefully that will quell some of our liabilities. When you start to look at some of the things we don't control, Colum always says we have to control the controllables. We're very grateful that this body is at least neutral on us pursuing moving to a fully self-insured program. Right now, we have fully insured products. We're hybrid. We have some fully insured and some self-insured. We believe that self-insured will save the state about $40 million a year. It will also give us the opportunity to better improve health outcomes for our members. We will control our destiny. I'm a former athlete. I'm always bet on me. And I think you all probably agree there. And I think in moving to self-insured, we're betting on us. We're almost 500,000 lives. We believe that we have the ability to deal with someone who goes to the doctor every month, every day, and we'll play the odds, right? Someone who never goes, and that will allow us to be more fiscally responsible. Those are the things that we can control. There are other things that are not necessarily in our control, and when they happen, whether or not it's federal changes or what have you, we adjust and we project.
So in particular, and I certainly understand the addition of 10,000 employees, but like the liability per participant, we're still seeing, I think it looks like 11% increase on average. Does that compare to other states, that 11% per year increase?
Colum wants to say something, so I'm going to say something and then turn it over to him. I'll say it. All states are not equal. And that's in every way. Certainly, we are in relationship. These folks sit on, actually, she's a national officer for the HERS of the country, of all the state folks who run benefits. So we have our pulse on what's happening, whether or not it is commitments to retirees or state employees or size or outlay. All states are not equal, and so it is difficult to compare even our neighbor right next door, Indiana, to Illinois. So I'm hesitant to make those sorts of comparisons. I can tell you that generally states are seeing increases. Whether or not the percentage aligns, I'll switch, turn it over to Colum to say more about that.
Sure. Thank you, Director. And as part of the report that COGFA puts out, there's that one section in there that actually includes Siegel's most recent annual survey. It's a very large national survey across the entire United States. It's very well respected. And if you had a chance to read that deep into the report, you'd see that, yes, we're not really that different. Like the director said, every state has its own unique differences. But overall, with regard to the inflationary pressures in the healthcare arena, we're not that much different from most other states. And the actuary that I actually use to help me develop the liabilities of the program, we rely specifically on the information put out in that Siegel report. And I talk to my actuary, almost on the daily, and trying to get as much information about what I don't necessarily have visibility into that might be going on in the industry. And I think it is just these kind of last two or three years where we've really seen just all of the inflationary pressures kind of come to bear. I don't necessarily see it being a long term, especially because, as the director mentioned, such a large component of that was based on the enrollment growth in the program. We went from about 95,000 employees in 2023, and we're at about 109,000 now. So there's only so much employment that you can actually have at the state of Illinois, so it cannot continue to grow at that rate just in that particular component of what's driving the cost. But there are also so many other things that we don't necessarily have the control over. If you look at specialty drugs, for example, for all of our self-insured programs, specialty drugs represent about 1.9% of our prescriptions. They represent about 44.5% of our spend. So think about that for a minute. If you think about, you know, all the commercials that you hear on TV, the ones you whistle along with because you see them so often, you know, these guys aren't out there advertising baby aspirin. You know, this is Skyrizi, and it cost, you know, I think we had about 300 utilizers in 2025, and that cost us about $28 million for that one drug. So there's one area that in and of itself is a problem that we have to face and we have to tackle, and it's a difficult problem. Pharma's got their hands in the pot, companies have their hands in the pot, and we're trying to control those costs on just that one component. And I could probably go on and take up all day and list about another 10 things of where we're seeing the pressures, but we're doing the best to try to manage those.
In that Siegel report you mentioned, is you're saying that's referred in this analysis? What page, do you have the page on that? I did not see it, but I have not gone through the entire booklet in detail yet.
I do believe, I think there may just be some national trend numbers. I'm not familiar with the exact page. I know that Anthony Bolton, who is the staffer on COGFA, I did deliver to him the entire report. And I'd be happy to have another conversation with him about it, if you'd like.
Yeah, I see it now. So, and I'll look through this. Maybe it's in here. I guess for folks on COGFA, so the page 21 report, it was what I was referring to as liability per participant, where we're seeing kind of 11% on average increase per participant. And that's where we kind of avoid looking at just the cost of 10,000 additional employees, but the per-cost employee. And you, I think, highlighted very accurately that we need to look at those things with high prescription costs. And so I'll go back to page 5-6 and look at that in more detail, but I'd be curious that liability per participant increase kind of versus other states. So if that's in that Siegel, I'll find it here in a minute, but if not, you know, that's what I was just kind of curious how we compare with, you know, Midwest and a national trend. But thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. As you mentioned, the director, as you mentioned, the switching over to the self-insured model, would that get rid of the need for HMOs and push people into the OAPs?
No, sir, not at all. So we will still have a choice. You can still either choose an HMO, OAP, PPO. We'll still have pretty much the same offerings. The difference is on the back end. Right now, a fully insured program, as Carrie stated earlier in an example, so if Kaler goes to get his knee replaced, whether or not he got both knees or no knees and he never went to the doctor, we're going to pay the same amount on Kaler's service. However, in a self-insured entity or schema, we're going to just pay for the surgery that he got. But then what we would actually be able to do in the aggregate is say, you know what, lots of people that kind of fit the profile of Kaler getting knee replacements. What can we do to maybe save that off for folks? And so do we need to start talking about joint health? So to your point, we can have a little bit more be well events around joint health or whatever the challenges may be. And so it also, in addition to just paying the claim for whatever service we get, it essentially opens the books, in my opinion. So the insurance folks plans aren't just making blind money. We pay what we owe. And more importantly, we will be able to assess claims data to serve our members in a different capacity to be able to improve health outcomes and maybe save off No one wants to get a knee replaced, even though it's cool you got the youngest knee in the room, I can guarantee it. No one wants to actually get there, right? How do we stop that from happening in the instances that we can? But choice will still be there. You'll still get an HMO choice. You'll still get an OAP choice. You'll still get a PPO choice.
Okay. Thank you. And then one last question. We're going to be hearing a little bit later about the impact of 340B drug pricing from both sides today on state employee group insurance. How does the 340B drug pricing program affect your current state employee group insurance plan, and the pending legislation, how will that affect it going forward? And obviously this is just the state employee group plan, it's not Medicaid or anything like that.
They're both pointing at each other right now, but I'm not it.
Yeah.
I'll take the non-legislation component of it. Yes, obviously the 340B entities that are allowed to make those purchases and then charge different amounts to health insurance companies, that does have an impact on us. We don't necessarily have the type of visibility into those exact drugs and that exact drug list and those prices, and we don't get to see the rebates that also come through on those drugs. So we know that the impact is there on us. We know that it is an inflationary pressure that we face, just another one of the long list, but I don't necessarily have the ability to be able to pinpoint the exact dollar value of that.
Is that because the information is not available to CMS, or?
And our contracts and our RFPs currently do not contain language surrounding 340B drugs for the medical side or the pharmacy side. That is something that we are looking at changing. Actually, the newest RFP that is out and available to bid on, which is the self-insured HMOs, does contain language regarding 340B drugs and pricing and rebates for those.
Okay. Yeah, and our PBMs can't run models for that to kind of tell us
the
effect.
No, because it's not something that is contained within our contract, so that is not information that is available to us.
Okay, and so would that be something that's we would be requiring insurance companies to provide, or medical providers, or pharmaceutical companies, or all of the above?
I would say all of the above.
Okay.
For our particular purpose, that information has to be referenced within the RFP when the contract is put out for bid, and then that information has to be in the actual contract that the vendor signs in order for us to have access to how those particular drugs would affect our program.
Okay. And then pending legislation, any effect on the state employee group insurance?
Again, we don't know what the effect would be because we don't have sight into that. That is one of the reasons why we are taking the proactive initiative, because there are at least, I know, two bills out there during this session that pertain to 340B drugs. So that was why we took the initiative to be proactive in our most recent RFP to include it.
Okay.
Yes, but to what extent is unknown?
Yeah, we don't know the numbers. I mean,
does it
affect rebates?
Yes.
Does it affect, you know, all those different
all
things
it.
That come in? Okay, I appreciate that. Senator Kaler.
It's a challenging position for us to be in.
I understand, absolutely. Thank you. Senator Kaler.
Yeah, and that happens to be my bill, the 340B bill, so I'm pretty invested in that. Do we negotiate rebates as part of our PBM contracts?
Yes. We aggressively, we now, what, have quarterly tracking? We know?
We receive rebates quarterly in arrears from all of our carriers, and we receive 100% of rebates.
Okay, good.
On the pharmacy side?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, how do rebates work? Rebates versus 340B, can both of them be working at the same time? It's one or the other.
Well, the formulary rebates that we traditionally refer to are going through the prescription drug side, right? I know we're all talking drugs, but these are going through the PBM, where the PBM is negotiating rebates on our behalf. Typically, the 340B drugs that we're talking about, those are purchased through that federal program and administered typically in like a hospital setting. So those are coming through the medical side of our spend, not the prescription side. So when we're talking rebates over here, it's definitely something that we have more visibility into, and we have a contract, because traditionally formulary rebates have been a topic, and whereas 340B is a little bit of a more nuanced and newer discussion that's been going on. So those are not the same contracts with our third-party administrators as it is with our prescription benefit manager. So two different types of rebates that we're discussing, and that's the language that Carrie mentioned that we are now proactively building into this new RFP that is just going to go out the door for very soon.
And I appreciate that. I think that the goal here is to better understand. I think the 340B discussion came up late last session, very late, and so I think that we're just trying to see what the impact is on Illinois taxpayers. So I appreciate that. Representative Moeller.
Thank you. Since we're on that topic, and I know we're going to hear from a couple of panels, I appreciate that CMS is being asked about this on our group health insurance, because I don't know if you'd have an opportunity to respond to the panels that are going to be presenting. But have you seen, so the bill that Senator Kaler introduced, and I'm carrying it in the House, restores the 340B program to what it was before restrictions were put on the program by the pharmaceutical industry in 2020. Has CMS done any type of analysis to see the difference on cost to our group health insurance plans pre-2020 to 2020 to 2026? Has there been a reduction in cost with the restrictions that the pharmaceutical industry has put on the program?
I have not looked at any historical data in that arena at all for all of those past years. I have not.
Okay. I think that would be important if there is an inflationary impact because of the 340B program, and the 340B program has been significantly altered in the state of Illinois over the last 6 years, there should be a cost savings to the state, conceivably, and I haven't seen that. So I think we would need to back up that claim or show what the impact is when we put restrictions on the 340B program, because what would happen if we don't pass that bill is that program stays in existence the way it is right now, and you're saying that it has inflationary impacts on our group health insurance plan. So I think it would be important to understand the difference between, you know, the impact pre-restrictions and now, if we're going to claim that it has a significant impact on the program.
Heard. I just want to caution, we will do the work. The world was very different pre-2020, so whatever information, it's not apples to apples. It's very difficult to extrapolate data in such a starkly different universe. That notwithstanding, we'll certainly get with our consulting partners who kind of check Colum's math to address what we think might make some sense, if we can make some sense of it.
Sure.
I will also caution, I'm very particular about the data that we present, and if people way smarter than me don't say this makes sense, then I would say we're unable to do that. And I just very straight shooter, so I don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. Just want to be clear about the kinds of ways that we assess and project it at CMS today.
Sure, but The comment was made that you're going to start adding this information to the RFPs that are going out. Where are the RFPs? Is it with Blue Cross Blue Shield, with the health plans? Is it with the hospitals? Like, where is the RFP?
The RFPs are being they're out on BidBuy. It's for an HMO. It's for the self-insured HMO plan, and that is what contains the language for that particular component. So it's an insurance carrier, who will be responding to provide that third-party administrator service for us.
Gotcha. And this was not done before. I mean, the program has been around since 1992. We've not requested that information in the past?
No, we have never requested that information.
Okay. And in looking at the Siegel study, and the impact of rising health costs, the pricing on like the specialty drugs in particular seem to be a big cost driver for inflation. Who sets those prices on the specialty drugs?
It depends. It is pharmaceutical companies. It can be our PBM. It depends on which plan, which pathway.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a complex marketplace, but it is the manufacturers, it is pharma that is driving the cost based on the cost of creating those drugs and all the R&D that it takes, and that's why we hire the PBM to work on our behalf to try and negotiate the purchase price of those drugs down as much as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, and I agree. I think that having that information is important, and looking at the difference in Health Alliance HMO versus the OAPs that a lot of people have transitioned into. I think my understanding is that there's more rebates on the OAPs. So comparing apples and apples to earlier and back to now, and I'm not trying to debate the bill. I'm trying to get more information. So I appreciate it. Senator Kaler, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I appreciate Representative Mueller's comments on that. To me, the big issue in 340B is going to be how the state receives rebates. So, I mean, the whole drug industry is dependent on rebates, and if you have higher-priced drugs and you have formularies, then the rebates should be higher on those because that's the way that market works. But so I think from here on out, we need to track what rebate revenues the state gets. In terms of the patients, the patient doesn't know whether they're a 340B purchaser or not, because the entities that are determined 340B are the hospitals, the FQHCs themselves. And so this can get into a long debate, but that's where we have to keep our eye on is the rebates.
Thank you. Representative Weaver.
Thanks. I want to go back to a point I think Representative Mueller made about specialty drugs. Earlier in testimony, did I catch that the cost for Skyrizi was $28 million amongst 300 patients?
Correct.
So
in 2025.
Yep. So $93,000 a patient. I assume that that's on the high side. But, like, can you help me understand how much of an outlier that is, or is it really not much of an outlier in that?
Well, he's about to tell you there's a drug that we've got like 20 people on, and it's $1.2 million.
I was obviously pointing them out because they are outliers. I mean, they definitely are the kind of the shock value number, if you will. I did not bring all of the data. I was just looking at our top 25 prescriptions, and some of them, mostly we look at the data by total spend to get on the top 25 list. So if you're a drug that has really, really high utilization but a low unit cost, then they're going to end up on that list. So I was just kind of going down the list to see, like, where are the kind of the very specific pain points. But and Skyrizi is not even, like, the most expensive one that was even on that list. But those are definitely the outliers on the high end.
So then I want to think about that in the context of how we do coverage mandates, and not like what we should be mandating or not, because there's things that we hear, like, heart attack prevention or, you know, coverage mandates for IVF, great things that we do, but just to get a sense of the cost. In recent years, have you felt the brunt of any of those mandates, specifically in higher cost specialty drugs, or just how those mandates have flown through to premium with what you guys see?
So that's a hard question to answer, because anytime, and once it's the law, we adjust.
Sure.
Right.
So it's kind of, are you saying it's just kind of baked in? And
yeah, I mean, it's hard to call balls and strikes on 158 folks who need Stelara at $20.8 million, right? If I can give you a better quality of life, that's what our job is to do. I think where we have spent a lot of time is making sure that whatever legislation is brewing, we have conversations to say, if this, then that, so that everyone is aware of what these implications are, to the good and not, right? Because you all, and we should be worried about fiscally, but we also have to think about, well, are we doing cost avoidance on this, or what we think we can do? And also, sometimes it's hard for me to come in, and when I say me, I mean my amazing staff, to go in and say, hey, this is going to cost you XYZ, but I can't even tell you how much it's going to save you. I just know it's going to save, because you're not going to have these other challenges. So it is both art, science, and math.
Yeah.
And honestly, a whole heaping thing of humanity. What makes sense for this, for our overall mission?
That's a good point. I appreciate that. That list that you mentioned, is that in one of these sheets that you gave me? Is that something we can see?
Yes.
Do you mind following up with me on that?
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Thanks.
Any more questions?
Okay.
I think, thank you, Director, everybody. We appreciate you always being here and being very straightforward, and all the work that you're doing to make healthcare better for state employees. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so now we're going to move on to our next panel, which is HMOs, OAPs, and Q-chip plans. We have, and I'm going to have each group go through the plans that they have while they're there, rather than going through HMOs, then OAPs, then Q-chip. So we have Aetna, Blue Cross, and HealthLink. I believe we have Margaret Huff and Robert Cascarano, Allison Mayberry and Tracy Womack, and Elizabeth Trekis. And then if you could, there are a few questions that you're going to hear for all of you. One of them will be, and if you can go ahead and answer these in your statement, we won't have to go through this for everybody. The first one, have you had any issues with providers asking people for payments up front? We have had that years past. Are there any changes of note that participants should expect in fiscal year 2027? And how has your provider network adjusted to the influx of new members from Health Alliance? Have you had any provider issues, provider access issues with these new members? So we can go ahead and start with, sorry, we don't have enough chairs right now. We can kind of switch out a little bit. If we can go ahead and start with Aetna, if you can go through your HMO, OAP, and Q-chip.
I think I did that right. Okay, good.
You may have to make sure you state your name and speak into the microphone if
gotcha.
We can. Thank you.
So, good morning. Leaders and members of the commission, thank you. My name is Robert Cascarano with Aetna. Want to first thank again all of you for the opportunity to serve you and all of your members. I also want to take an opportunity to thank CMS, in particular Director Devon, Carrie and Colin. They're wonderful to work with, great partners. And selfishly, if you would indulge me, I also want to thank my friend Margaret Huff here, who her entire world is to make sure that Carrie and the team and your members have a good experience with that night. You know, they mentioned the road show of open enrollment meetings next month. My friend here will be at every single one of them. So she's very, very dedicated to making sure the state has a good experience with us. We currently have four separate contracts with the state, representing approximately 320,000 members. We have an HMO contract that's been referenced today that represents approximately 22,000 members. We are in the fourth year of a five-year contract. That is the contract that is currently transitioning to an ASO arrangement that is out to bid. The proposal is due on April 29th, so we're in process of responding to that right now. We also have an OAP that's been referenced, approximately 72,000 members. We're in the fifth year of a five-year initial term with 5 one-year renewals. We are also serving approximately 47,000 PPO members. We just renewed that. It's a three-year contract with 7 one-year extensions. And then finally, we also have a Medicare contract representing approximately 177,000 retirees, and that is in the fourth year of a five-year term. We were also asked in the formal invitation to be here today to reference any litigation with the state of Illinois or any other state. We are not in any litigation with the state of Illinois. However, we did last year receive a subpoena that we answered questions to as our role of plan administrator as it relates to the state of Illinois. And that was all that I had in terms of our prepared comments. You let me know what we need, what you need, want us to do next.
Any provider payments up front or in fiscal year 27?
My friend Margaret has the answers to those questions.
There's no provider payment issues at this time.
Okay.
Yes. And there were no issues with Health Alliance transition from members. So we did a very good job working with CMS. Lots and lots of questions in the roadshow last year. But we did confirm that in our quarterly utilization review with CMS as well, that they have also had no member escalation complaints. But you have lots of folks that bring those to our attention if they're there, but none on that scope.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Blue Cross.
Hi, good morning. Nate, I'm so sorry. There we go. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. So it's my esteemed honor to be in front of you all, the committee, and thank you for having me this morning. My name is Tracy Womack. I'm the Vice President of Major Accounts with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. So thank you. Thank you so much, committee, for this time to speak with you all this morning. At Blue Cross Blue Shield, we serve two plans. The OAP plan, we have a little over 50,000 lives in that plan. And the second plan we have is an HMO plan, a little over 38,000 lives. So collectively, we have over 90,000 of the state members that we partner and take care of. I'm very proud to do that each and every day. Our plans definitely include HMO, and as our partner here mentioned, we are under RFP for the HMO plan at this time, and we are looking to support and provide feedback to retain the membership for the HMO self-insured plan. Very excited about that. The OAP plan we have right now is good to June 30th, 2031, and we look forward to continuing that partnership. We've been with the state since 1998. Very, very proud to have that deep partnership and fluidity with the state members. One of the questions that were asked to Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, were there any litigations that we are under? And the answer is no at this time. I know the question was asked as well, were there any payments that members had to make to providers? The answer is no at this time. And I know there was another question regarding Health Alliance and that transition continuity of care. We are proud to say that continuity of care went extremely well. We gained over 23,000 members from the state to Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois. So just as you stated about your surgeries, all pre-authorizations were done seamlessly. And that's what the members should expect. They should not feel the impact of a plan exiting. They should feel a seamless integration as we do at Blue Cross Blue Shield each and every day. And I would like to answer any additional questions from the committee.
Okay. Let's go ahead and do HealthLink, and then we can ask questions afterwards.
Good morning. My name is David Placer. I'm the Regional Vice President for HealthLink, and behind me is Stephanie Berner, a dedicated member of our team supporting the state of Illinois and the employees, the road shows, the open enrollment meetings. So I want to recognize her. We're in partnership with Ameribend as the TPA, and Ameribend is supporting the state of Illinois in another capacity this morning. So I'm speaking up for HealthLink only. Any questions related to Ameribend, we're happy to take back to them. And Elizabeth, who's on your agenda, will be happy to get those information to you. In terms of total membership, we represent just over 63,000 lives, a little over 30,000 employees. I think your question related to providers, are any members being asked for payment up front? No, at this time, we do not have any information that that is being requested. If that changes, we'll let you know. And as it relates to the transition of new membership this past year, we saw an increase of 4,500 lives due to the difference of providers in the market. We're grateful for that membership. And there was, to our knowledge, no abrasion in supporting those members. A reminder that HealthLink is a network. And TPA partner Ameribend on the back end is helping support the members, adjudicate the claims, et cetera. So HealthLink and Ameribend work in partnership on that. Happy to answer any additional questions as well.
Thank you. I believe Senator Severson had a question.
Just follow up with Aetna on the, we talked earlier about the Advantage plan. Can you just explain how that works when an employee or retiree sees a non-network provider, how that is paid?
Yeah, we noted that question earlier.
In terms of the Medicare Advantage plan, I noted that for Rick Frohmeyer, who was not able to be here today. So I need to confirm what the provider bills to us if they're part of the ESA plan. So if they're not in-network in the PPO MAPD, but they take Medicare and will bill us, I don't know the answer. I need to check on that.
So you find out if there is a separate billing? Because the question would be is why be – if they're going to get paid the same, whether they're – or if they can charge a – higher amount than, you know, why be in the network.
Exactly.
But if
I have a guess, but I don't want to guess in front of you, so okay. I will take it and then I'll give
you. All right, so if you are paying, so if there is a increased cost to the state for going out of network, otherwise, right now you can see any provider that accepts Medicare.
That's correct.
Under the plan.
That's
just
correct.
Who's going to be a liable. For that. Now, as an Advantage plan, then we have all the other rules because you've actually given up Medicare. I mean, so you've given up Medicare and you're with an insurance plan. So we've got the pre-authorization issues and all those. We don't offer even a supplement option that the employees can pay the difference. Has that been discussed at all to offer employees dual choice if they would like to have a supplement versus an Advantage option? Has that been part of the RFP? And that may be more of a state issue we can talk about later, I guess. But
so that's a question that Carrie behind me would answer.
Okay.
An hour later, I don't know. Okay.
Carrie Wolf, Statewide Chief Benefits Officer. That's really a question for CMS because we are the ones that place the RFPs for contract and choose what types of plans that we are going to place out for bid for our membership. We have had, obviously, as you know, multiple discussions over the last several years whether or not a Medicare supplement plan is would be advantageous to our members. we plan to do have some conversations with our consultant team and do a brief study on the population to determine what types of plans would be best for our enrollees when the time comes that we go to RFP again. I can say that when initially in 2013, when this particular type of plan became available to the membership, that study was done, and it was determined at that particular time that the best plan for our membership and how they utilize care was the Medicare Advantage plan and not a Medicare supplement. But we will do our due diligence again at the time when we choose, when we go out at the end of this contract and we go out for bid to determine at that point in time what is best.
Having both with the same carrier clearly would help from a, so it wouldn't be additional, there's not a net cost or not a loss, but having that as an option because retirees don't, you know, think if they're willing to pay the difference, it doesn't cost the state anything, but there clearly are issues or concerns with Advantage plans. Just ask mm-hmm. the hospitals and the doctors and others about the limitations that come with Advantage plans versus supplements. So why not give employees a choice? If it's not costing the state anything, why would we not want to offer an employee's that choice if they wanted to have that option of actually keeping Medicare as opposed to giving Medicare up? So I hope you'll we'll consider that. Again, if it's cost neutral, why not give retirees a choice? Again, it could be with the same carrier, so there's no loss to the carrier from their overall revenue, but I hope we will at least keep that in consideration because we hear a lot about people wanting to have that option to have a supplement versus Advantage.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Any more questions? I think we can move on to the next panel. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is our other providers. Delta Dental, CompSych, Metropolitan Life. We've got Darren Avant, Thomas Prinsky, and Scott Rogers.
This is motion one.
Okay.
That's motion two. So Mulder's going to make the motion on this one. This is going to make it on that one. Okay. We're going to do that one right after this panel.
Okay.
Is that better?
Perfect.
Okay. First of all, thank you for letting us join you this morning. I'm Karen Gligowski. I'm a senior vice president with Delta Dental of Illinois, responsible for the sales and account management teams. Been with Delta about 15 years. The first statement that I would like to make is that Delta Dental does not have any pending regulatory issues with any state agency, and we're not under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other Attorney General. Secondly, just to give a refresh of our relationship, we have 390,000 members with the state of Illinois, recently added the teacher's retirement system, so thank you for that. My husband's a teacher, now has Delta. We have just recently negotiated our renewal for a 5-year additional term with an option for a 5-year extension. We have not had any issues with providers requesting payments up front. There are no significant changes to the plan for 2027. And I'd be also happy to have Darren introduce himself since he's been on the state of Illinois account for 2 decades.
My name is Darren Avant, Senior Account Manager for the State of Illinois. I've worked with the state for the past 15 years and pleased to continue in that regard.
Be happy to take questions.
Any questions for Dr. Dental? None? Okay. We'll move on to CompSych.
Introduce yourself.
Hello, good morning. My name is Tom Prinsky. I'm a senior account manager with CompSych. Thank you for the time to discuss our benefits from the past year. Firstly, CompSych does not have any litigation involving the SEGIP or any pending regulatory issues with any state agency. We are not under investigation by the Illinois Attorney General or any other state attorney generals. Servicing a total population of state active state employees of about 78,269. And then just as a quick refresher, the CompSych EAP is offering, again, active state employees short-term counseling of 5 free confidential short-term counseling issues, legal, financial, work life, critical incident support. We also support several personal and professional development sessions across the calendar year. So the main primary presenting issues we've seen over the past calendar year in terms of the short-term counseling has been pertaining to stress, anxiety, relationship, psychological, and depression-related cases. And then of those cases, approximately 68% have been virtual, and the other 28% have been in-person, face-to-face. So I'm happy to address any questions as it pertains to the EAP.
Any questions from the committee? So most of your counseling sessions are telehealth?
Traditionally, most of the sessions have been in-person or face-to-face. We are seeing that there's a bit more requests for virtual or telephonic counseling sessions.
And is that primarily in non-urban areas, or is there a difference?
Primarily in non-urban or rural areas.
Okay. Any other questions? Let's move on to Metropolitan Life.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Scott Rogers, a senior account executive representing Metropolitan Life Insurance. We provide life insurance for approximately, as of last year end, 117,000 employees and 102,000 annuitants and their eligible family members. We've been the life insurance provider since July of 2021. And in our final year of our first of 2 5-year contracts, we have no plan changes for the upcoming plan year. We also have no outstanding regulatory issues with the state or its agencies and are not under investigation from the Illinois Attorney General or any other attorneys generals.
All right. Any questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
At this point,
I think we're going to take 2 motions. Is that correct? The first motion, Representative Miller.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Pursuant to 5 ILCS 375/5, I make a motion to approve the proposed renewed version of the following contracts for FY 2027, Delta Dental, CompSych, and Metropolitan Life.
Is there a leave? Leave? All right, there'll be 10 voting yes, and the contract is that motion is approved. We have a second motion, Representative Sisnowski.
Pursuant to 5 ILCS 375/5, I make a motion to approve the proposed renewed versions of the following managed care contracts for FY 2027, Blue Cross, Blue Advantage HMO, Blue Cross HMO Illinois, Blue Cross Blue Shield, OAP, Aetna, HMO, Aetna PPO, QCHP, Aetna OAP, and HealthLink OAP.
Any questions about that? Is there leave? All right, leave. And so the motion will be approved, 10-0. All right, thank you for that. We'll now go on to ongoing contracts for FY27, other providers, CVS Caremark and iMed. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Nicolay representing iMed. Go ahead. Okay, thank you. Yes, we currently have no ongoing litigation or regulatory actions by the Illinois Attorney General or any other Attorney General or the federal government. IMED has been privileged to be the state's eye care provider since 2005. Our last renewal was in 2024 for a 10-year period. There's no recent plan design changes. Our estimated total membership for all state employees is around 470,000. The main state plan has about 380,000. Local government health plan, 2,500. College insurance, 8,300. And the teacher's retirement insurance program, which we commenced in 2025, has about 79,000 members. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Severson.
Thank you. And it's again, it's probably more of a CMS issue necessarily than IMED. I think IMED's got a good network of choices, which is good for employees. The plan that's in place is a probably less than basic. It's, you know, it's a plan that most employers in the private world, on the health side, you have incredibly rich benefits. On the vision, it's one of the worst, just from a benefit standpoint. Most providers will say you're better off using a coupon off the paper than using the state's plan because of the high office copays and 2 years on on getting frames and then the amount of copays on all the other ancillary sides are usually not any better than again you can get with that. So maybe that's more of a state thing that gets negotiated than you, but that's something I think that should be looked at because I think that is a concern. So maybe that's more of a CMS issue that you can be looking at and reviewing that plan because it is a pretty weak benefits plan. But from an IMED standpoint, I don't think that's a problem. Again, you've got a good provider. You're only covering what's been negotiated with CMS. So it's not an indication at all on the employers. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Sosnowski.
Has there been, speaking of the benefits, have there been any change in the what we cover for eye exam frames, vision, contacts in the last X years?
No, I couldn't say there have been any changes. I have to ask the question how far back that goes, but there's been no recent plan changes whatsoever.
Okay. Now, maybe you have to tell us the secret to your sauce here, but it looks like national healthcare trends, vision only increases about 1-1.5% over the next number of years. It looks like you and dental are all under 5%. I guess just general question you don't answer now, but if we haven't made any changes to the benefit, and maybe it's a question for CMS, I can always follow up with them later, but, you know, even at 1%, it seems like, you know, we probably should consider some incremental increase in our benefit. So my question is, other states, other areas that you provide, have their benefits bumped a little bit, you know, 1-2% here and there every 5 years, anything like that?
I think that's very much a state-by-state question, Representative, just as far as the budget situation in each state, what they feel comfortable with. You know, here in Illinois, as with other states, we negotiate with CMS on our, you know, respond to our FPs, and that's the benefits that are offered. So,
okay. All right.
It varies quite a bit.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, Caremark and CVS.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Pretty loud. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Dan Foster. I'm an account director from CVS Caremark. CVS Caremark currently manages around 235,000 state employee group insurance plan members, a contract we've maintained since July of 2015, if I'm not mistaken. And as far as I'm aware, we are not under any current litigation with SEGIP. As far as the plan itself, I'm happy to answer any questions, although I will proactively acknowledge I'm kind of pinch hitting for members of our team that are either in transition or traveling right now. So any specifics I may have to get back to you on.
Any questions to the committee? Yeah, you got it easy.
Just fill it in.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll move on now to our favorite subject, 340B pricing program impact on state employees. We have the Illinois Pharmacy Manufacturers, IQVIA, and National Alliance for Healthcare Purchasers. So if you'll... So I don't know who wants to start, but go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us. I'm Sean Grimminger, President and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. We are a nationwide trade association based in Washington, D.C. We represent about 45 regional employer purchaser coalitions around the country, including the Midwest Business Group on Health, which is headquartered in Chicago and represents many.
Can you pull the mic just a little bit closer? I'm having a hard time.
Certainly.
Okay.
The Midwest Business Group on Health, which represents many self-funded employers and purchasers around the state and the region, including the state of Illinois, the city of Chicago, and many other public purchasers. By way of background, I've been working on 340B as a policy expert for over 20 years. I was a lobbyist for the Children's Hospital Association and then later the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems. I'll just take a quick step back and talk about the origins of 340B for a moment, kind of where it is today, and then what the impact is on self-funded employers and purchasers, including, of course, the state of Illinois. So 340B, really the origins date back to 1990. In 1990, Congress passed the Medicaid drug rebate program, recognizing that Medicaid was spending quite a bit of money on prescription drugs, and they said we'd like to spend less, and so they instituted a drug rebate program. But there was an unintended consequence. Previous to that time, some public hospitals, core safety net hospitals, community health centers, had been negotiating direct discounts with drug makers to be able to purchase their drugs at a lower price. Under the Medicaid drug rebate program, it effectively says that whatever the best price is that a drug is offered at in the commercial market becomes the price that Medicaid will pay. And so if a drug company had negotiated a discounted price to a community health center, that became the best price, and the drug company sort of unilaterally withdrew those discounts, saying, I can afford to give it to you, community health center or public hospital, but I can't afford to give it to the entire Medicaid program at that price. So not surprisingly, community health centers and hospital systems came to DC and said, this is a problem, right? Understand what you're trying to do with prescription drugs for Medicaid, but our prices have now gone up. And Congress stepped in and said, yep, understood, unintended consequence, let's fix it. And so they created the 340B drug pricing program, which I like to say is, was a program designed to be so small they didn't bother giving it a name. Literally, it's called 340B because it just sits at Section 340B of the Public Health Service Act. So when 340B was originally created, Congress envisioned that it would go out to sort of all the FQHCs in the country and a fairly small number of core hospitals, safety net hospitals around the country. They originally figured it might be 100 or so. Over the last 30-something years, 340B has expanded dramatically for a number of different reasons, probably the biggest one being that more people since 1992 qualify for Medicaid. So the way that hospitals get into the program, community health centers, Ryan White Clinics, and others are in by statute, but the way that hospitals qualify for the program is they have to serve a certain percentage of Medicaid and low-income Medicare patients. As more people have qualified for Medicaid, more hospitals have qualified for the program. Today, it is a much larger program than I think was probably originally envisioned, depending on how you count it, $80 billion at discounted 340B prices or $200 billion at sort of total prices, making it the second largest drug purchasing program in the country after Medicare Part D, and growing, on average, 15 to 20% per year every year. So I want to talk about what this means for employers in the commercial market. As the previous panel was discussing, most self-funded employers purchase their drugs through a PBM. those PBMs negotiate directly with pharmaceutical manufacturers on rebates, right? So you might have a very high-priced drug, the pharma manufacturers will negotiate a rebate, and the PBM purchases at that lower price. Those rebates are at least theoretically passed on to plan sponsors, to the employers. Not always the case. There's a lot of problems with PBMs. We recently passed federal legislation to rein in PBMs, which was fantastic. We strongly support it. But at a core level, we are paying the discounted rebated price. When a drug is purchased instead through 340B, effectively our rebates are crowded out by the 340B rebate. So imagine a hospital system, and at this point 340B has become quite large, and most hospitals now qualify for the program. And as you all know, many large hospital systems have very broad, large outpatient networks. If a patient, let's say a state employee, receives a prescription drug from, we'll say, Northwestern Memorial Hospital, but they're prescribed a prescription drug by a clinician affiliated with Northwestern, they go down to their local contract or their local pharmacy. If that pharmacy has a contract with Northwestern Memorial, they're able to purchase that drug. Northwestern Memorial has bought the drug at a discount, and they sell the drug to the patient or to the employer that that is employing the patient at the list price of the drug. We no longer get the rebate. And the reason for that is that in pretty much any PBM contract I've ever seen, I cannot say that I have looked at the PBM contract between the state of Illinois and your PBM, but they universally say, we will not pay rebates on drugs that are sold through 340B. That's because the drug makers don't want to pay a rebate on drugs sold through 340B, which is, I think, understandable, right? They're already having to sell the drug at a discount through 340B. They can't afford to then also pay a rebate to the PBM. So the net impact on employers is that our prices have gone up substantially. There are different estimates. I think Rory is going to talk a little bit about what that means, but I want to be very clear. This sort of crowd out of rebates is one of the major ways in which 340B is costing employers money, but there's two others that I think are worth noting. So one, 340B hospitals in particular, less so community health centers and Ryan White clinics, they, on average, and there's been good academic evidence to support this, they purchase more drugs than non-340B clinics. They purchase more expensive drugs because the more expensive the drug is, the bigger the margin is, and they mark up the price of their drugs more than a non-340B clinic. And I'll point to a report from the treasurer in the state of North Carolina. They looked into this issue, recognizing that this was costing the state quite a bit of money, and they found that the average markup on a cancer drug for a state employee in North Carolina was 5.4 times the purchase price of that drug by the hospital, and that those markups were 84% higher than for a non-340B hospital. So that's one. There's sort of a prescribing pattern problem. The second problem is that 340B encourages market consolidation. And I don't want to say that all market consolidation in hospitals is due to 340B. There's a lot of other reasons why hospitals choose to consolidate. We've seen enormous consolidation across the United States. But imagine you are this is big in oncology because so much of reimbursement in the oncology space has to do with the price of the drug. If you're an oncology practice, it doesn't matter whether you are in the north side of Chicago and you're treating all, you know, commercially insured patients, or you're on the south side or the west side of Chicago and you're treating mostly uninsured patients. As an independent practice, you do not qualify for 340B, full stop. There's just nothing in the statute. However, if you become part of a hospital system, again, whether you're located on the north side, the west side, the south side, downstate, once you're in the part of a hospital system, if that system qualifies for 340B, that practice qualifies for 340B. And so there's a profound incentive for both the hospital to buy that practice because they're able to leverage the price arbitrage, and there's a pretty profound incentive for the clinicians involved, right, because they're going to be able to make more money by being as part of a larger system. Market consolidation among hospitals increases prices across the board, not just for prescription drugs, but we pay substantially more to provide care or to pay for care in hospital systems as opposed to outside of hospital systems. And one of the main things that employers and purchasers try to do is actually move people out of a hospital-based clinic and into a community-based clinic because we often are paying a fraction of what we would otherwise pay. So as we look at what's going on in for the state of Illinois, you know, you are the largest purchaser of healthcare in the state. You're the largest employer in the state. I think Rory will probably be able to bring some additional figures as to what the estimated cost is. But there's no question that 340B is significantly increasing the cost of providing healthcare to your employees. And, you know, I would suggest that that this is a worthwhile area of inquiry. I know there were some good questions for the previous folks at CMS. Other states have started to ask sort of deeper questions about what's going on in 340B. The state of Indiana passed really meaningful 340B transparency requirements last year. We've not yet seen the first report. The state of Minnesota passed probably the first comprehensive law on the issue. Of course, the state of North Carolina did the treasurer's report. My suggestion to you is that this is a worthwhile area of inquiry as you consider sort of the future of the state employee health program.
Yep, thank you. And we're a little limited on time here, so if you can be concise, I appreciate all the background on that. But we've got three more speakers to go, so go ahead and introduce yourself.
Good morning. My name is Rory Martin, and I lead a team at IQVIA doing research in the U.S. healthcare system. IQVIA is a global provider of data, advanced analytics, and services and for the life sciences industry. And thank you very much, Senator Kaloff, for the opportunity to speak today about the some of the research that we've done about the 340B program. We've published about 20 different studies on it. And, just a couple of things. So one of the interesting things about 340B is I think it's a program of contradictions. Sean mentioned some of these, but for instance, 340B, as he mentioned, we estimated using IQVIA data last year in terms of 340B sales, it's somewhere between $180 and $200 billion. That is now approaching the size of Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D, you might be aware, has about 56 million beneficiaries, so 340B is enormous. And then since 2018 to 2025, 340B program tripled in size, and it grew at more than three times the rate of the rest of the drug market. So it's big, and it's getting bigger. One of the contradictions, though, is that many people had never even heard of the program. And one of the things I wanted to point out is that sometimes 340B is described as being parallel to, like, you've got your commercial plans, state and local government plans, Medicare, Medicaid, and 340B is described as being like another payer channel. That's completely wrong. It actually cuts perpendicularly across all of these. So you can be a state employee plan and you'd be using 340B drugs. You can be Medicaid and using 340B drugs. You can be Medicare and using 340B drugs. And that's where this collision occurs in terms of the rebates and the 340B discounts. I'll leave it there, I think.
Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Weaver.
Thank you, Leader Kaler. First of all, I just want to thank you for this. Man, I think some people think that there's an incentive for, like, using the most confusing words in reports and, like, they're impossible to read. This was so easy to digest, and I learned a lot just from reading it. So thank you for that. I want to think a little bit about just the headwinds and tailwinds, because you talk about a lot of the headwinds, right? Drugs being priced above the standardization, the middlemen price going up, cost of consolidation. But I also think that there's probably some tailwinds that are helping. Like, number one, I wonder if the cost to employers, you know, is still higher on the net, but there may be benefits of more money being into the system. So while they're being charged more for premiums, there's maybe less of a cost for hospitalization because those hospitals are getting revenue in other ways. And I also know that there's this stat that you said that that we haven't seen the benefit of charity care. I think it says that it goes down from, like, I have it here, 2.49% to 2.15%. But I still got to think that there's, like, care that's otherwise not happening without this. And there's rural hospitals that are open that otherwise wouldn't be because of this. So I know I said a lot. Maybe how do I digest the headwinds and tailwinds of those things?
So this question of cost versus benefits is central to a lot of the policy debate that's going on at the moment, and it's central to a lot of the litigation that's happening. We actually did a study of some of the benefits of 340B. So, you know, 340B is a drug pricing program. We asked ourselves the question, are drug discounts being shared with patients at contract pharmacies? Contract pharmacies are in the news, that, you know, it's central to the legislation that Illinois is considering. And so we asked two questions. How often is the 340B discount being shared with the patient at contract pharmacies? And when it is shared, how big is the discount? And what we found using, I think it was about 4 years of data, this is a national sample, between 3 and 4.7% of branded prescriptions at contract pharmacies, the patient actually gets any benefit at all, any financial assistance at the pharmacy counter. And then, so it's not very often that it happens. When it does happen, however, the discount averages about 87.5%. So it's a large discount. So I describe this as being akin to winning Powerball. So when you win Powerball, it doesn't happen very often, but when it happens, it's a really good thing. To put that in context, there was a recent study that was done by the Commonwealth Fund, so a separate group. They estimated that the percentage of U.S. adults that are either underinsured or uninsured is 32%. So 32% versus 3 to 5% of actual discount sharing at the contract pharmacy. You can agree, I hope, that there's a big difference between those, that there's a lot of unmet need.
If I may, I think
yes.
The way that you described the issue, I think actually does get to a core piece, which is that 340B is and really has become sort of a core revenue mechanism for hospitals, right? Many hospitals rely on 340B funding to do other things. And in fact, that's sort of kind of consistent with the way that the program is at least theoretically supposed to work. I guess the question I would have, again, thinking about it as stewards overseeing the state health plan is this the best way to provide additional supports to hospitals based on real challenges as to like how well targeted the system is? It's not well targeted, right? Very large, sometimes very profitable hospital systems are getting a lot of money. In the state of Minnesota, a single hospital, MHealth Fairview, which is the teaching hospital at the University of Minnesota, is receiving more money in the net on 340B than all of the state's rural hospitals, community health centers, and Ryan White AIDS clinics combined. And you, the state of Illinois, let's assume that there's maybe a similar dynamic happening here, you're paying more, right? Every employee or every employee who is served and their dependent who is served is paying more for prescription drugs to then provide more money into the hospital system. I think it's a reasonable question to ask, is this the best way to provide additional support to core critical safety net providers? I think it's absolutely reasonable to say we want to make sure that rural hospitals in downstate and other places keep their doors open. But there may be a different way to do that that isn't necessarily increasing costs as an employer. That's the case for the state of Illinois.
Could you remind me, who are you?
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. What you said.
I'm Sean Grimminger. I'm president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. So we represent self-funded employers and purchasers across the country.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
And we have another question from Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Leader. I had a question regarding the comment that you made about, this is for education, 340B clinics buy more drugs than non-340B clinics and charge larger markups. Mm-hmm. Who negotiates that markup?
In the context of 340B, I guess in the commercial side, it would be the health insurer that is negotiating what the actual net price is of whether it's a prescription drug or any other service.
Right. So it's not the 340B clinic, it's the insurance plan that negotiates with the drug industry on what they're willing to cover and pay for their insured.
In this case, it's more on the medical benefit side, but yes, it's the insurance industry. The reason that 340B covered entities tend to have higher markups is that they are part of larger health systems on average, and so institutionally they just have more leverage to negotiate higher prices.
Okay, but it's not a creature of the 340B program. It's a creature of how our health industry is funded. So I just want to be clear, the insurance industry is negotiating with the pharmaceutical manufacturers on how much they're willing to pay for the drugs that they cover for their patients.
That's right.
So the pharmaceutical industry is part of determining what that markup is.
Not quite within the 340B context, because in 340B, the pharmaceutical industry doesn't have a choice. They are required to sell the drug at the 340B ceiling price.
Right. I understand that, under federal guidelines, the pharmaceutical industry is required to sell their drugs to 340B entities at a certain discount. But I'm talking about when the pharmaceutical industry is negotiating with the health plans, it's a negotiation between the pharmaceutical industry and the health plans on what the cost of that drug is going to be, and the cost of that drug to someone who has insurance under a health insurance plan, not Medicaid, not Medicare, if they're, you know. So the negotiation is between those two entities. The clinic is not, or the hospital is not involved in the price of that.
No, I'm afraid that's not true. And I apologize, but so particularly in the context of 340B, the drug company will sell the drug at the 340B ceiling price to the hospital system, right, or the community health center or others. The negotiation on what the commercial rate is then actually a product of negotiation between the health insurance carrier and the hospital itself. So the hospital gets to decide how much they want to charge for that drug when it's sold to a commercial payer.
But who determines the price of the drug that is sold to the hospital?
The 340B program.
No, for people who are covered by a health insurance plan, who determines the price that the hospital has to buy the drug for?
So outside of 340B, let's say if you're a non-340B hospital, it would be a negotiation between the drug maker and a group purchasing organization that purchases the drug, usually on behalf of a very large set of hospitals, right? So that would be a negotiation between effectively the hospital industry and the drug industry.
Okay, and do they typically, are the price, the typic, those negotiations typically reflect what patients who are in fully insured plans or have health insurance, what they pay?
No. So hospitals in general engage in significant price markups when they purchase a drug. And this is not even within 340B. So we'll put 340B aside for a second. Hospital drug price markups are significantly higher than PBM markups. So if a drug is sold for kind of in the medical benefit, employers are often paying 2 to 5 times what they would otherwise pay for that drug if it was sold in the pharmacy benefit as an outpatient drug.
So that's just a function of how our health industry works, how our health care landscape is, and whether it's 340B or non-340B.
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely correct. I guess the sort of underlying point is in 340B, the hospitals are actually able to purchase at an even deeper discount than what they would get through their GPO.
Right.
And that none of those savings are passed on to, you know, the state of Illinois, for instance, as an employer. The state of Illinois does not save any money. In fact,
we spend
more because we're not getting the PBM discount that we would otherwise get.
Right. But that was how the program was designed, the revenue from the difference between the higher drug price and the discount for people who have insurance who are at these, who use these, you know, the 340B hospitals, that revenue is generated to help support patient care for people who don't have, for patients that are Medicaid, whose rates are a lot lower than what a, you know, private health insurance would pay, to cover the cost of people who have no insurance. Like, that's how the program was designed.
Yeah, the program was designed as a price arbitrage program.
Yeah. Thanks.
Could I add to that briefly?
Yes,
if possible. So there's the cost per unit, and then there's the total cost, which also depends upon utilization. So my group did a study of this. We published this in Health Affairs last year. What's actually driving the size of the 340B program? Is it pricing or is it utilization? And what we found was that over 80% of the dollarized program growth is actually based upon utilization, not pricing. Okay, so it's pricing has a role to play, but it's much broader than that. Most of the growth for 340B, at least, is coming from utilization increases.
Just a comment, not really a question. You asked the rhetorical question about is this the best way to cover rural hospitals or FQHCs? No, it's not. No, it's not. But you know what? Congress gives us the tools that we have to use. And when we have, rural hospitals in our area or FQHCs or poor people that are now being kicked off of Medicaid, we have to respond to our constituents. And so given the tools that we have, because Congress ought to do its job and ought to revamp this whole thing, but they haven't, and so we're now left with making what we can out of this. So that's where the response is coming from. And, you know, when Representative Weaver asked the question about the rural hospitals, yes, this is a big deal to them. This is a big deal to the FQHCs. And so if there's a better tool out there, by all means, bring it forward. But we have to deal with what we have in front of us. So, yes, Senator Searson.
Sure. And a couple questions on that. First of all, on the can you give me an idea on the amount of dollars spent on 340? How much is spent in rural areas versus urban areas?
I don't have those particular statistics on me, but we can look that up and get back to you on that.
Okay.
I don't either, but I one at least one thing, of course, you know, Illinois and Minnesota are not the same, but Minnesota is the only state that currently has any reporting out which shows which hospital system, well, how much every covered entity is making in 340B and how much they're not. It doesn't explicitly break out by rural versus urban, but because we do have covered entity level information, we'd be able to get that information to you. Okay. And I do think actually there's at least, although Minnesota's smaller, sort of like Illinois, it is dominated by sort of one large metro area and then a fairly substantial rural area. And so there may be some sort of indicative amount.
I'm guessing in Illinois, it's even though we talk about it, it's really used to help rural areas. Majority of this money is going into urban areas as opposed to rural. But ultimately, these dollars, when we hear from federal health clinics, we hear from hospitals, these dollars are needed to help take care of the fact that they're losing money on serving either uninsured or underinsured or Medicaid rates. So this is just ultimately the fact that the state underfunds Medicaid at such a dismal numbers, they have no other choice but to find another revenue stream. And so they're going after the pharmaceutical industry to tax them to make up for the fact that we are underfunding the other side of it. So unfortunately, the pharmaceutical industry gets hit with this tax, which, as you know, no business pays a tax. So that means it's just cost shifted to somebody else. So it's the private sector or private insureds that end up having to pay for it. It's not the employer at the private sector. They just pass it on to the employees as well. So ultimately, the whole program is necessary because HQFCs and hospitals are struggling because the state doesn't fund Medicaid to the levels they should, and there's no other place that they can find revenues to take care of that. But this isn't really about helping consumers. I think you mentioned very few consumers see any benefit from this. This is about funding the shortfall in those two other. So it's not fair that we're taxing the pharmaceutical industry to make up for the state's short funding on the Medicaid side. But until that gets done, I'm not sure what other alternative ultimately there is. But I appreciate you at least sharing the fact that this is clearly a cost shift to taxpayers, and this is just another hidden tax that ultimately gets paid to because of the Medicaid underfunding.
If I may, I just want to underline what you said, Senator Representative.
Excuse me, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We have senators and representatives here, so I get confused. Absolutely right. I mean, it costs the pharmaceutical industry money, right? They're having to sell their drugs at a discount. That's not my business or my problem. I think the reason that we're here is to sort of underline the fact that you made, which is it's costing taxpayers in the form of all the public employers out there, so the state, the city of Chicago, and others, and all of the private employers, which are paying meaningfully higher dollars. So if we sort of accept that that's what 340B is doing, I think it's just worth noting, eyes wide open, that working families in Illinois are paying more money for prescription drugs and paying more money for health care overall in order to shift money out of their pocket and into the pockets of provider systems, again, some of which I think desperately need it, and from my perspective, some of which probably don't.
We need to move on here. One more question, Representative Davis-Meyer.
So does the federal 340B allow for targeting to ensure that
you know, FQHCs and rural access hospitals are receiving these funds over a larger hospital system that may not be in need?
No, I mean, that would be a reasonable policy direction for Congress to take. And I will say I was a federal advocate for many years. Unfortunately, the kind of odd thing about 340B is, unlike a sort of government-funded entity, where the government actually comes in and says, all right, we've got a bulbous of money, here's how much we're going to give to you and to you and to you, which is, of course, a political decision. In 340B, once you qualify, you can sort of utilize the program however you want. And it is not surprising that sort of very large health systems have more money to invest in sort of upping how much money they're making in 340B, which is part of the reason why, as you said, in Minnesota, you know, a single hospital was making more money in the net on 340B than all of the state's rural hospitals and community health centers and Ryan White clinics combined. Partly they're just smaller volume, right, which makes sense. But they also have less ability to sort of invest the dollars to make sure they're capturing as much 340B revenue as they can. I think a reasonable policy direction, at least at the congressional level, would be to say, if we're going to have this program, which I think is totally valid and worth having, is how do we make sure that the rural hospitals, community health centers, and others are really able to maximize how much they're getting out of it, and that might come at the expense of, you know, a larger hospital system, which, you know, may itself not have as much of a safety net focus.
Yeah. So, I mean, we do a lot of programs based on, you know, percentage of Medicaid service provided or something of that sort. So that would be just a little bit more targeted. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to the next panel.
Thank you.
So please come forward. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Kaler, Chairman Davidsmeyer, and members of the Commission. My name is Jason Reddish, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Illinois Primary Healthcare Association, which is the association that represents the federally qualified health centers in the state of Illinois. I am an attorney at Powers, Pyle, Sutter, and Burville, which is a law firm in Washington, D.C. I work with health centers all over the country and primary care associations that represent health centers in many states. I've worked exclusively on the 340B program for the last 14 years, representing the providers, the covered entities. In the interest of time, we've talked a lot about the importance of 340B to health centers. It is critically important to health centers and other safety net providers, including Ryan White HIV/AIDS clinics and hemophilia treatment centers, STD clinics. But the 340B program supports health centers in two important ways. First, whenever a health center has a patient who can't afford their medication, who is uninsured, who has a high unmet deductible or a high copay, it lessens the loss. They're able to give those drugs away or at substantial discounts, and it doesn't hurt as much as if they had to pay full price for the drugs. The second factor is what we've been discussing, which is when a patient's insured, they're able to generate resources. For grantees, those resources have to be reinvested into their program. That's a federal grant funding requirement. The money gets turned right back around into the project, stays in Illinois, and helps provide health care to Illinoisans. Health centers use outpatient drugs in a few different ways. They do administer drugs in their clinics, but far less frequently than you would think of in a hospital setting or an emergency room setting. This is an outpatient drug program. And health centers are primarily accessing outpatient drugs when they write prescriptions while providing primary care to their patients. Some health centers are fortunate enough to have their own pharmacy. If they have one core location, it's convenient for their patients, it may be financially viable for them to run a pharmacy inside the health center. Most can't do that. If they're in a rural area and they have multiple outposts, there's no one place they can set up a pharmacy that's going to be convenient for all of their patients. Pharmacy is a tough business. Even with 340B, it can often be non-economical to run your own pharmacy. So health centers, more than any other provider type, are very dependent on contracted pharmacy partners. They contract with independent mom-and-pop pharmacies. They can contract with chain pharmacies if that's where their patients either need to go or choose to go. And they can sometimes contract with mail-order pharmacies or more specialized pharmacies. Beginning in 2020, drug manufacturers started to restrict shipments to those pharmacy partners. And that has been a very painful development for health centers in particular. Some of these manufacturers will allow the health center to have a single contract pharmacy if they don't have an in-house pharmacy. Some of them say if you have an in-house pharmacy, any in-house pharmacy, you can't use any contract pharmacies, which means that the only place they get to use 340B drugs is in their in-house pharmacy. Overall, we have 40 manufacturers that are imposing some form of restrictions on 340B providers generally. 25 of those impose restrictions on health centers in particular. Hundreds of manufacturers have no restrictions at all. They continue to ship drugs to contracted pharmacies, but the 25 that affect health centers are the bigger household name drug companies that we all know. These restrictions prevent health centers from extending discounts through contract pharmacies. The last panel talked about how a lot of times 340B discounts don't get delivered through the contract pharmacy, and in some cases that's true. When a patient expresses that they're going to have difficulty paying, the pharmacy will send them back to the health center, and the health center will investigate, is there a cheaper drug? Is there a manufacturer assistance plan? Can the health center itself provide assistance? So they don't get the discount at the pharmacy counter, per se, but the contract pharmacy does serve as a deflection point to send the patient to where they can get help and actually get those drugs. When we can't get 340B drugs to our contracted pharmacies, we can't deliver those discounts to patients where they need to actually pick up their prescriptions. And, of course, we lose reimbursement. When we can't get the drugs to our contract pharmacy partners, we can't generate the resources that we reinvest into our programs. And this is not a theoretical impact. Health centers are closing. They're shutting down locations. There are other financial pressures on health centers, but this is a big one. So there's recent legislation. Sorry, do you have a question?
And I want you to, you know, the purpose of this hearing here is to look at what the impact is on the state employees. So I want you to address that as well.
Yes. So the recent legislation that would protect health centers' ability to use contract pharmacies, there have been criticisms that that bill would increase costs for the state employees group insurance program. And the basis of that claim is generally that the state will lose pharmaceutical rebates if there is increased utilization in 340B. 21 states have passed legislation like this. 20 of those states had no fiscal impact note on the bill, and some of those states have had their bills in effect for 3 or 4 years. Arkansas passed in 21, Louisiana in 23, and then a cluster in 24. Only one state, Utah, had any note relating to potential increases on their public employee program, and they noted that there would be a potential $2 million impact on the rebates that they could collect if 340B utilization increased as a result of them restoring the status quo and passing their contract pharmacy protection law. Rebates are just one variable. CMS talked about that a little bit today. There are so many variables that increase drug spend. The list price is obviously the biggest one, what the price of the drug is established at by the drug manufacturer. In 2023, list prices on average were 35% higher than in 2022, just inflation of the starting point price of the drug. The rate of drug price increases beats inflation consistently. It has for 30 years. It's about 1.5 times the rate of inflation in recent years. There have been a lot of executive orders trying to penalize manufacturers for increasing their list price faster than the rate of inflation. And then advertising is a big factor. In 2024, AbbVie spent $700 million combined to advertise Skyrizi and Rinvoq, just two of their branded products. The loss in rebates, to the extent that there is any, is also mitigated by a lot of important factors. Health centers are the backbone of primary care in rural and urban areas because it's the one place a patient can go even when they can't afford their copay, even when they can't afford health care. By allowing them to benefit from the 340B program, they're more financially stable. They also stay open. They provide preventative care. That prevents patients from getting hospitalized. Things like diabetes and cholesterol and heart conditions, the types of preventive care that when patients access, they don't need more expensive interventions, are what health centers do extremely well. Health centers also serve as patient-centered medical homes for patients where they see where the patient is getting all of their health care, and they have a better snapshot of all the medications and barriers that a patient is experiencing. In general, we believe health centers save the health system money by preventing patients from showing up in emergency rooms, requiring lengthy hospitalizations, and otherwise not receiving care. Of course, one of the main beneficiaries of 340B in Illinois are the public entities, the public hospitals. There are a number of health centers that are run by county health departments. There are a number of sexually transmitted disease programs and Ryan White programs that are run by county health departments across the state. So not only does the 340B money benefit the state, it often benefits the same entities that are employing these individuals and can result in them being able to provide more comprehensive health care to their own employees. Lastly, the 340B discount often is greater than the PBM rebate, especially with drugs that don't have competition. For a branded drug that has very little competition, there's less incentive for a manufacturer to provide a significant rebate. But if the price of that drug is increasing faster than the rate of inflation, the 340B discount could be substantial. It may result in a lost rebate in some cases to the state, but the outsized impact and benefit that the providers are getting is very significant. So in short, we think the benefit of the 340B program for the very providers that the employees may rely upon, sometimes the providers that actually employ these employees, outweighs any potential rebate loss. I'll note that Utah, the state that did identify a potential loss in rebates, passed the bill and signed it into law. So I appreciate this opportunity, and I'll allow Jordan to address some of the hospital issues.
Let me just add Senator Sims to the roll, please. Jordan, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you, members of the commission. My name is Jordan Powell. I'm IHA Senior Vice President of Health Policy and Finance, and I want to thank the commission for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of our more than 100 340B hospitals across the state. As you've heard, 340B was created to help hospitals and community health centers stretch scarce federal resources and care for vulnerable and uninsured patients. Hospitals use these savings to provide free and reduced-cost medications, behavioral health services, cancer care, and to sustain access to care in both rural and underserved communities. In Illinois, 70% of 340B hospitals are either a safety net hospital or a critical access hospital. Now, the pharmaceutical industry suggests that House Bill 2371, legislation that unanimously passed the Senate and is currently pending final action in the House, will increase costs for the state health insurance group program. But I want to be clear about a few things. That legislation does not expand the 340B program. It's not asking for anything new, and it comes at no cost to taxpayers. House Bill 2371 simply preserves the original intent of the program by restoring the long-standing ability of hospitals and FQHCs to partner with multiple pharmacies, just as they did for years. These partnerships are essential to ensuring patients can access affordable medications in the communities where they live, while also enabling providers to expand critical healthcare services. So now I want to talk about some facts, because I heard a lot of claims in the previous panel, but not a lot of facts. You heard from Jason that since 2020, pharmaceutical manufacturers have imposed restrictions on our partnerships with pharmacies. These are actions that have no basis in federal law or regulation. These restrictions have resulted in significant resources leaving the state of Illinois. They have created real consequences for patients and providers across our state. And that is why now more than 21 other states have now taken action to limit pharma's restrictions. Our legislation is modeled after those states. Pharma has alleged in those states, the same as they're doing now, that their state health insurance costs would go up. So other states are going through the same exercise that we're going through now. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever, with the exception of one state, that state health insurance costs have gone up or will go up due to 340B. At the same time, COGFA's own March 2026 group health insurance report projects prescription plan rates and costs under the group health insurance program in FY27 will increase more than 10% next year. And it's important to note that these increases outpace both the medical and dental plans for FY27. Now, COGFA's March report also references a 2026 Siegel Health Plan Cost Survey that suggests the driver of double-digit increases for prescription drug coverage is due to utilization, replacement of existing drug therapies, and marketing.
Let me repeat that last finding. A major driver of prescription drug increases is drug maker advertising. Now, looking back at previous Siegel surveys, prescription drug costs have been rising at nearly double-digit rates for some time now. As I said, these restrictions from pharma went into place since in 2020. There have been no reductions in costs or any reductions in these double-digit increases from pharma since these restrictions have been put into place. So to suggest that the 340B program is driving or will drive drug costs in the group health insurance plan is just another pharma-funded and misleading claim. This is substantiated by data showing it is the increases in the pricing of prescription drugs that's increasing faster than medical inflation that is causing the increase in drug costs in the group health insurance plans. In addition, as you all know, a great deal goes into the negotiations between the state and its public employees and retirees. The most recent changes resulted in many retirees being transitioned into a Medicare Advantage plan administered by Aetna. To make some connections here, Aetna is owned by CVS Health, which also operates the PBM CVS Caremark. CVS Caremark was recently sued by the Federal Trade Commission over allegations related to insulin pricing practices. Again, we take significant issue with pharmaceutical manufacturers, many of them located and headquartered in foreign countries, constantly attacking this program and hospitals. As we think about the challenges of the state year's budget, I would remind the Commission that Illinois hospitals have and always will be a strong partner with state government. If we want to talk about taxes, the hospital assessment tax is a major revenue source for the state's underfunded Medicaid program. The savings from the assessment to the general revenue fund exceeds $3 billion, with more than $500 million paying for non-hospital services. We're committed to our partnership with the state, but we need the tools such as 340B to sustain it, as hospitals are facing rising labor costs, increased drug prices, and growing uncertainty around the federal Medicaid program. And I know there have been some references to that. Protecting 340B helps ensure patients can access medications, it supports community-based care, and it strengthens hospitals and community health centers across Illinois. In short, 340B is not part of the problem here. It is the solution. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Weaver?
Thank you, Leader. I'm just a quick follow-up. So I appreciate the data-driven approach, and it's kind of hard to read between the lines of what we're hearing from different parties. So can you just help me reconcile? In CMS testimony, we had heard that expansion of 340B will have a negative impact on the state health system. So how does that jive with what we just heard?
The PBM rebates are negotiated between the payer and the drug manufacturers. And we have heard comments that some of those contracts do deconflict. If a 340B discount's offered on a drug, then the PBM rebate may not be available. There is potentially impact depending on the manufacturer, depending on how they handle those rebates. But from what we've seen and what we've seen projected in other states and from what we've seen from IQVIA's research, it looks like that impact should be minimal, especially compared to the benefits that the state receives from having the provider stay open, the hospital stay open, the patients having a place to go to get their routine care to prevent more serious, more expensive care. I know Utah, again, they projected about a $2 million rebate loss, which was a low single-digit percentage, I think, of their rebate dollars.
What do you – so when you say that you expect the impact to be minimal, like what data informs that view?
Just 21 states have passed these. Mm-hmm. Some of those states that I have been involved in, West Virginia, for example, has a huge state employee fund. West Virginia University is one of the largest employers in the state. They were very concerned about what 340B protection legislation would do to their state employee costs, and we had meetings, the FQHC Association in West Virginia, we met with them. Within a year, they stopped asking for meetings. They stopped raising concerns. They weren't seeing the increases that they feared.
That's one state. It's anecdotal. This is a contractual issue. Just like 340B is the silliest solution you could come up with to fund safety net providers, and I will be happily out of a job when Congress finds a better way to do it. PBM rebates are a pretty silly way to fund insurance plans, and we get all of these different strange incentives, and you know, whenever you touch one thing, you're going to touch four other things, and that's the nature of healthcare and any, not just what I work on, everything that that everybody works on. So there are going to be 100 variables. This is one of them, but we have not seen it be substantial in any state that's passed one of these protective laws. And like I said, 21 have come before you. And coming into this year, there were 12. So we have 12 states with at least a full year track record, and we're just not seeing the impact.
Any other questions? Yes. Senator Davis, Representative Davis.
Hey, I just got a raise.
Not a raise. Promotion to the Senate. Upper chamber, huh?
Demotion.
So I think that if you want to talk about advertising of drugs, I think that that would be a great conversation to have. There's nothing I like hearing less than if you're allergic to drug D, don't take drug D. But we see all those. When you talk about, so I understand there's a need for funding for hospitals. You're saying 340B is that funding source. Like we're not, we don't think that this is not the right funding source for hospitals. You're saying 340B is that funding source.
I think I'm understanding your question correctly. It's one of the funding sources that hospitals rely on. Absolutely.
Absolutely now. But in the future, you know, I think there's a lot of agreement on both sides of the aisle that it's probably not the best funding source for hospitals, but it's what we have now, right? I mean, is that fair to say?
It's what we have now, and again, the benefits are being restricted by pharmaceutical manufacturers, and Chairman Davis-Meyer, as we think about the changes that Congress made to the federal Medicaid program, and we talk about headwinds, we know those are challenging, and we are significantly concerned with you know, people falling off Medicaid and the impact that's going to have on hospitals and the communities that we serve.
Yeah, and Medicaid reimbursements, as Senator Severson said earlier, are certainly part of that equation. We have to talk about realistic reimbursement for service. But, you know, I look at this and I feel like, you know, we keep talking about FQHCs and we keep talking about rural access hospitals, but we're not focusing our dollars and our efforts on those services. We're using those services to prop up large, giant hospital systems, and I'm not attacking anyone. I'm just saying, you know, we're using a need over here to prop up the entire system, and that's my concern with the 340B is the more use we have of 340B, the price for everyone else has to go up to cover costs, right? Or to cover advertising or whatever. I'm okay with getting rid of advertising. As I said, not a huge fan of that. But, you know, I think that we have to have a real discussion on what other funding sources we can have, because hospitals have to be there, right? And we certainly all understand that hospitals have to be there. My concern is that 340B may not be the right funding source, but it may be the only source right now. So I understand the competing sides, and I appreciate the opportunity for everybody to come and actually provide information. Certainly CMS has more information that they can provide and should provide, but we want to make sure that funding's there so that our communities and our constituents have the services that they need. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
And let me just get a word in about the big health systems, because Peoria is home of OSF, which is the fourth largest hospital system in the state. They serve a lot of poor people. So it's not that we're just, you know, trying to protect the large health systems. They do the job. They take those monies and they put them to the use that it's supposed to be used for. So I just, you know, I mean, we're concerned. We're focused on rural hospitals and FQHCs, but the big systems also do their job. So, you know, just be sure to correct the record. Any other questions on that? Don't want to go for another couple hours?
Sure.
All right. Seeing no further business, we're adjourned.